You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Millions of years ago, incredible forces ripped apart the Earth's crust, creating 7 extraordinary continents. Now a new series from the people who brought you Planet Earth and Blue Planet will reveal how each continent has shaped the unique animal life found there, but also feature the many challenges faced by animals in a modern world dominated by humans. Presented by legendary naturalist Sir David Attenborough, 7 Worlds, One Planet is a 7-part television event that marks the first time that BBC Studios' Emmy-winning Natural History Unit has explored all of the planet's continents in a single series. 7 Worlds, One Planet premieres Saturday, January 18th, and today I'm joined by the remarkably talented and adventurous documentarians who filmed this monumental series, executive producer Johnny Keeling and producers Emma Napper and Chadden Hunter. We'll discuss how BBC documentaries have turned nature programming into global television events, the logistics of filming on 7 different continents at once, and how their first episode is hoping to raise awareness and support for fire relief efforts in Australia. They talk about some North American polar bears who have found a surprising way to adapt to climate change, how agriculture is threatening over 2,000 endangered species in South America, and how Pacific fishermen, who had nearly driven the whale shark extinct, are now finding ways to help this magnificent creature thrive again. Plus snakes, scary kangaroos, the real Tasmanian devil, and a monkey that looks like Don King. Coming up with the team from BBC's 7 Worlds, One Planet in just a moment. Following the Emmy-winning series Planet Earth 2 and Blue Planet 2, a new 7-part series called 7 Worlds, One Planet tells the story of Earth's 7 spectacular continents and how they shape the extraordinary animal behavior and biodiversity we see today. 7 Worlds, One Planet airs on Saturday, January 18th at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on BBC America, AMC, IFC, and Sundance TV. And today I'm talking with the executive producer, Johnny Keeling, Chadden Hunter, who produces the episodes covering North America and South America, and Emma Napper, who produced the Asia and Australia episodes. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, this was just a fantastic show. And some of the footage that you captured just blew me away. You know, I always loved nature films, but it's just amazing to me that in my lifetime, nature documentaries have gone from airing on public broadcasting with fairly small audiences and minimal fanfare to having entire networks dedicated to them now. And these programs like Planet Earth and 7 Continents that are these huge, huge global TV events attracting massive, massive numbers of people. John, what would you attribute this explosion in the popularity of nature documentaries to?
Well, I worked on Planet Earth 1 and Planet Earth 2, and that was sort of the beginning of it. Really felt like it started to get really popular then. I think part of it is to do with social media, that people start talking to each other about what's going on, and so that kind of helps. I think that a lot of people now live in the city. I think it's more than 50% of people live in urban areas, and I think they really want to connect with the natural world, and these sorts of films help them to do that. And so there's a fascination with wildlife and nature. So I think those are a couple of the reasons why these programs, you know, do well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Planet Earth and Blue Planet took a very macro look at our world. What was appealing about being able to take the time to explore each continent one episode at a time?
What I really like about it, what I love about it actually, is that each episode is a continent, and that gives you amazing variety. So, you know, before on Planet Earth 1, Planet Earth 2, we covered habitats, so it might be mountains or jungles, and so it's quite sort of singular in that. But this, you know, imagine the variety you get in the North America episode alone. You know, you'd have mountains and polar regions, you might have deserts and forests and even coastline and stuff. So that's amazing variety. We all come from a continent as well, so it's not an abstract thing. You know, if you're talking about a desert, it's sort of, it might not mean much to you if you're not coming from, you don't live in a desert, you weren't born in a desert, but everyone comes from a continent. So it should, you know, the audience should really relate to that. Yeah. That's what I like about it. We can talk about real places and real locations. And I love that about the series.
And I believe that this marks the first time that BBC Studios' Natural History Unit has explored all of the planet's continents in one single series. What kind of logistics go into making a series of this scope?
I mean, it's huge. It's 4 years in the making. We have a team in Bristol in the UK of maybe 25 people approximately. And then we work around the world with 1,500 people. And we did more than 90 expeditions. I think it was 91 expeditions to 41 countries.
Wow.
And we shot 2,260 hours of footage over about 1,800 days. So it is a huge, huge undertaking with a really brilliant team of people, both in, like I say, in Bristol, but also we work really closely with scientists and field workers and, yeah, just people from all around the world. It's a big, big undertaking.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And I understand that in response to the fires in Australia, the network has actually decided to shift around the release schedule and open with Australia for the first episode. Are you hoping that you can put more attention on Australia's plight and maybe even inspire viewers to support the relief efforts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think across the series, we hope people fall in love with each of the continents and they're surprised and astonished and sort of celebrate the diversity of each of the continents, but particularly Australia at the moment. I mean, it's a really catastrophic situation. Mm-hmm. So we hope that people love the wildlife there and are moved to do something.
And Emma, you produced the Australia episode as well as the Asia episode. What's been most heartbreaking for you about watching the devastation over there?
So the episode itself doesn't include the fires because they happen after we finish filming. But to me, watching those on TV, then I feel like everybody else does. What a horrible human loss, what a horrible thing to happen to the wildlife. But also, we filmed in quite a few of the locations which were affected by the fires.
Oh, really?
And like I said, they don't feature in the program, but we filmed a species of spider that hadn't been filmed before, dingoes and kangaroos, lots of sort of filming first in these amazing locations. So I've just also kind of got a personal sadness about seeing some of those locations be affected by the fires. Mm-hmm. And obviously hearing from people on the ground that we work with who are like our friends now, telling us how they've been affected.
And it's all the worse, I suppose, because apparently mammals in Australia are going extinct faster than anywhere else in the planet. Aside from the fires, what's threatening them?
So I really wanted in the Australia episode to show the incredible diversity that is there. It's really not like anywhere else on Earth. It's been isolated for so long. It's just a... you just land there, and there's all sorts of strange creatures there. But they, over the last sort of 200 years, they've been affected by Europeans arriving in Australia and bringing with them lots of animals that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. So foxes and dogs, lots of animals from elsewhere in the world, and guns. So there was a lot of hunting, and it means that all these incredible creatures have been squeezed into tiny little pockets. So we explore that in the program. We show Tasmanian devils, which are a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah.
They're just so charismatic, so sweet, and they used to be found everywhere and now are in tiny little pockets. So So that's what we explored in the episode. But the significance with the fires is that now, because of that, these animals are just in tiny pockets. So if we, they're just so vulnerable to that final bit of habitat being lost.
Yeah, I absolutely love the part with the Tasmanian devils. I never knew how small they were. My wife was there a couple of years ago, and she's only seen Tasmanian devils in Warner Brothers cartoons. So yeah, she was shocked at how teeny tiny they are.
Yeah, they're especially so cute. The babies. And they're called imps as well, which I think really, really suits them. But yeah, they're incredibly sweet and inquisitive and shy.
Now, what's the most difficult part about filming a dingo hunting?
I think
not someone hunting a dingo, yes, to clarify, right, yeah, but a dingo yeah, who is in the process of hunting prey. Yeah.
Okay, so people ask us a lot, how do we film these sequences? How do we know where to go? And we are so thorough. We talk to scientists, and normally before we go out, we're working with somebody who's seeing the animal every day. We know a lot about it, and the dingo was nothing like that. So I was desperate to film dingoes. They're such an iconic word associated with Australia.
Right, and the dingo ate your baby.
Yeah, exactly. But
which is a myth, right?
Yeah, right.
There's never been an actual dingo attack on a baby, right?
But they, but yet you look, and there's very little footage of them in the wild. So I think I just got stuck in my head that I really wanted to do this. So we ended up talking to a lot of national parks and eventually found this fantastic ranger called Benno, who said he'd been sitting, drinking some beer, and he'd seen a dingo. And I was like, okay, well, then let's go and try. And we essentially sent a crew out for a few weeks at a time, then a few more weeks, until eventually we managed to start being able to track and follow this incredible female dingo, who is just one of the most, fantastic, strong animals, incredible hunter. And Johnny, you directed some of that sequence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's amazing, this dog. I mean, if you think of a sort of small or medium-sized dog, and she's running down the fastest, strongest animals in Australia, and she's chasing them over miles and miles and miles. I mean, it was just, it was amazing to see her tenacity and her strength. And she's, she's quite wily as well. But it was difficult because they're living in a huge area, and we're trying to sort of spot, one or two dogs kind of appearing. So we'd go days on end seeing nothing at all, and then suddenly she'd reappear out of the woods, and then we'd be up trying to film her. We had a drone, we had a camera on a helicopter as well. We had people in vehicles around trying to kind of spot her. So it was a big effort from a team, and we ended up getting a sequence, like Emma said, which just hasn't been seen before. People haven't seen dingoes hunting kangaroos.
Mm. It must take a remarkable amount of patience to do what you guys do.
Well, people say that, and I sort of think, the thing is, I'm so happy when I'm outside watching animals. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like a chore. It doesn't feel like patience to me. It just feels like a very mindful thing to do, to sit and watch wildlife. Yeah. But yes, we do take a long period of time to film things, because usually, in the first week or two, you're trying to work things out, like Emma was saying, with the dingo as well. You're trying to just work out, what is that animal going to do? Mm-hmm. And that's really exciting as a biologist. We're all three of us sat here, all kind of have PhDs in zoology. So we love watching animals. We love spending time with animals. But it's sort of, you spend a few weeks working out what's going on, and usually everyone says, oh, we managed to get it in the last week. There's a reason for that. It's because you've just about cracked what the animal's doing, and then you're able to film it. So you need the time in the field.
It must be a very meditative when you have to actually wait for that shot. I mean, there are very few times in our lives these days when people have to wait. We're in the line at the DMV or something here in America, we're on our phones or our iPads and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's really true that to be in a place, often we're in locations where your phone doesn't work anyway.
Right.
So you can just leave that. And actually, it's really lovely to be somewhere for a month and not have to be looking at your phone.
And it's focus. You have to get into the mindset of the animal. Each animal's different. To film it, you have to understand it. So it takes that time, doesn't it, to focus and to spend time with the animal. And then once you've understood it, you can start having some success with filming it, hopefully.
Yeah, and one thing I know is that apparently Australia has more venomous creatures than anywhere else in the world. Did you have to contend with any of that?
Yes, I don't know. People kind of calls? Ask me, like, was there a time when you got attacked by something? And Australia doesn't feel like that to me. Like, you're, especially if you're filming something a little bit dangerous, that's what you're concentrating on, that animal. But it's just that the environment's booby trapped. So so if you walk through the forest, it's just stuff that will get you. There's spiky plants and there's dangerous spiders, and you'll see in the making of for the dingoes as well, that walking through there, the crew came across sort of nearly trodden a brown snake, and one of the ground director got completely covered in some very nasty biting ants.
Yeah, Yeah, there were snakes and ants, I think, were the only kind of mild irritation in that location. Yeah. But actually, generally, I think animals are more afraid of us than anything. So they usually move out the way.
Sure. I mean, but Australia just seems like one big death trap to me, which is why it's interesting to hear that there are more mammals that going extinct there than there are anywhere else in the world. Because I think of us humans going there and us being the prey. And I'm not so much worried about snakes and that kind of thing. But I'll tell you something. Kangaroos terrify me. Everyone thinks that they're so cute, and there's old footage of people boxing with kangaroos and all this stupid stuff. But you know what? I've seen footage of kangaroos. They're terrifying. I mean, I've seen kangaroos with six packs that no human I've ever seen has, and those claws. My God. And so some of them are like 7 foot tall. I mean, I would not want to run into a kangaroo in the wild, probably more than anything.
To me, it's not terrifying. Most of that episode has hopefully loads of animals you haven't seen before that you didn't know existed. But the kangaroo is one I think that most people know exists. But it's really funny for me, like you've got it in kids' books, but then you go to Australia and you see it in real life and you're just like, that is just not real. I mean, it's just, what a crazy, what a crazy animal, but they're very cool.
What I like about this series is Emma managed to film them in the snow as well. So there's lovely surprises in every episode.
Lots of surprises. Not a lot of snow in Australia.
No, and not very much snow. And yet Emma's got a lovely sequence in her program of wombats and kangaroos living in the snowy mountains, which again just surprises everyone.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. There's a lot for investors to be optimistic about these days. The S&P is up over 400% since March 2009, but what about you? Have your accounts more than quadrupled in the past decade? The truth is, most stock investors don't achieve the same performance as the overall market, leaving two-thirds of Americans still feeling like they'll have to work after retirement. What would you do if you knew that the big banks and institutions tend to not follow the same advice they give you? What if you could learn where they buy, sell, and make profit? With Online Trading Academy, you'll find out more about their patented investing strategy designed to help you trade with the skills and confidence of the pros. Sign up for a free introductory class with Online Trading Academy. Visit otatrade.com/majority for two free tickets to a class in your area and get a professional insider's kit just for attending. That's otatrade.com/majority and start knowing now. otatrade.com/majority. And Chen, you produced two episodes for Seven Worlds, One Planet covering North and South America. You captured just some mind-blowing footage of polar bears, and I guess they have been threatened by global warming and long summers that come with that. So they have found this impressive way to adapt to their circumstances. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've filmed polar bears in the past. I worked on series like Frozen Planet, and so you kind of think you've seen every polar bear story there is. And this was an amazing new tip-off that this one location in Hudson Bay in midsummer, these certain polar bears had learned how to climb on top of boulders, very, very specific rocks, and wait till the high tide came in. And with the high tide was coming in beluga whales. And these belugas are at least twice the size of a polar bear. You know, they're a big slab of muscle. Yeah. But these bears had learned that if they wait till just the right second, the belugas come past the rock and the bear can jump on, and with just the right bear hug, if you like, and bite on the back of the neck, they can get a massive meal in summer. Now, it's such a remote location that we can't say for certain how long they've been doing this, and we can't say for certain that this is in response to climate change. What we can talk about in the film is this an example of the kind of adaptation that polar bears might have to get more used to as summers get longer? We do know that Canada is the fastest warming country on the planet. We do know that summers in the Arctic are getting longer. Winter sea ice is the main thing polar bears need for hunting, and that's getting shorter and shorter. So yeah, there's one story which we've never filmed before. I mean, it's unbelievable behavior when you see these whales and polar bears playing this weird chess game. Felt very new to us, and it might be the kind of thing that will keep some polar bears alive.
Just to be clear, polar bears do not typically, as far as we knew, go after beluga whales,
no,
right?
No, no, it's incredibly
that
rare.
Was totally new information. Huh?
Yeah, and then they've opportunistically a polar bear might mm-hmm. might try and leap on a beluga whale off the edge mm-hmm. of the ice, but
but their main diet is what, seals?
Seals, yeah, yeah, and they'll wander around on the sea ice, and mm-hmm. and through winter they're generally reasonably well fed, but summer they're generally it's a time of starvation, and polar bears lose about a third of their body weight through the summer. They're waiting on land, waiting desperately, waiting for that sea ice to come back. But when you saw this one group of bears, when we first came across them and noticed how sleek and fat they were, we thought, oh, wow, these guys are onto something. You know, we knew they had some trick up their sleeve. Wow. And what it's interesting watching the bears learn from each other. They're very, very cunning. Bears are opportunists, and they're looking for new opportunities. So to watch these bears watch each other get on these rocks and learn which rocks work, which rocks don't work, it was fascinating to watch an animal use its intelligence and its learning ability to just, you know, crack the code, if you like.
Your team also got some incredible footage of tornadoes in the American prairie. Tornadoes are notoriously unpredictable. How dangerous was that?
Mm. Well, a lot of that footage came from a lot of different sources, and there are some really dedicated storm chasers that put themselves on the front line. We knew that we wanted to capture big weather in North America. It really defines the continent. Mm. When we're looking at each continent, we wanted things that characterize that landmass to really give it a feel. And we knew that North America has the most dynamic change of the seasons anywhere. I mean, the heat of your summers and the depth of the snow in the winter, the beautiful autumn colors. It really was it needed to be a seasonal story. Mm-hmm. And big weather was something that really felt North American to me. So we knew we had to make it part of the fabric of that film. And tornadoes are spectacular. They're terrifying, but the footage is absolutely mesmerizing. And so that was something that we knew to tell that unique weather system in North America. You get mini tornadoes other places, but nothing like Tornado Alley in the Midwest. So it had to be an iconic feature of the film.
Yeah, here in the States, we have some version just about everywhere of a saying that goes, if you don't like the weather, either wait 5 minutes or drive 5 miles.
Yeah, so, yeah.
How does that weather diversity affect the biodiversity in these areas?
Yeah, well, we were always looking for stories that linked back to our themes on the continent. And when we were looking at extreme weather and seasonality in North America, we came across a kind of a theme that really was to do with pioneering animals. It was it fits a really lovely, I guess, American human narrative as well about pioneers really exploring this country. And so many of the stories are of animals really pushed to the extreme. It's whether bears have gone right to the coast and even beyond that, at low tides, they're fishing. Or it might be that manatees have extreme winter cold snaps, which can kill them. And these manatees are having to find their way through waterways in Florida hundreds of miles to find hot springs just to survive. So across all those stories in North America, there was a real pioneering spirit theme that came through. It was animals really going that extra length. Lynx in Canada pushed further north than any other cat in the world. So it really, it fitted that there's a lot of really heroic characters, I think, that came through in the North America episode.
And in the episode on South America, which you produced, I was completely shocked to learn that I guess 2,000 species in South America are under threat. And you have this amazing satellite footage that illustrates the rate at which farms are encroaching on forest lands. It was just astonishing. With the explosion of agriculture in that region and the prosperity that comes along with that, is there much will among the people there to slow that down?
Yeah, we in each episode, we didn't want to shy away from the issues facing the continent. So every episode in Seven Worlds has a conservation story. And in South America, it felt like deforestation was probably the biggest single issue there. So we didn't want to shy away from it. And it is horrific, the imagery. But we did find stories of locals defending wildlife. There's a wonderful little monkey called the cotton-top tamarin. He's got hair like Don King. It's like something you've never seen before.
It looks like Beethoven.
Yeah, these wonderful, huge white shocks of hair on their head. And they only live in this tiny pocket of forest in Colombia. There's a tiny remaining number of them. But the locals there have defended them and stopped the encroachment of farms. And those monkey groups, they're stable right now. They're one of the rarest monkeys in the world. But working with those locals in Colombia was a really heartwarming experience. And we made some extra clips about them, some extra behind-the-scenes films, because we needed to tell these stories about conservationists on the front line, you know, everywhere we went. And each one of these continents, there's amazing locals doing amazing things. And so, yeah, we're not shying away from the big issues, but there are some hopeful stories out there.
And I think that's in every episode as well. There are some stories, as Chadden says, of animals being challenged and the issues, and some quite sad and despairing stories. But we also have really good stories of hope, like Chadden says, across each episode. There's stories where, I mean, Emma, you have one in Asia of whale sharks, don't you?
Yeah, so we filmed a relationship between whale sharks and the fishermen that work in the waters off Southeast Asia, and sharks have been hunted many to the brink of extinction, including the whale shark. But now there's been a protection on them. So instead of hunting the sharks, people are feeding them and getting a lot of joy out of that relationship.
Right, fishermen too.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Fishermen. Yeah, and it's to me that's quite hopeful, because we can all make changes like that, and I think I really hoped as well, when we highlight the problems the natural world's going through, you ask, can the people there do anything? And obviously we're all responsible for our own continents, but a lot of these are global problems. So you can also think, how can my behaviour, how can I do something a bit better to help forests around the world or fishing around the world?
And Asia is another place that has experienced explosive growth and an insatiable hunger for natural resources. How is that impacting the animal population there?
The loss of forest in Asia is having a huge impact on wildlife. So we were lucky enough to film an animal called the Sumatran rhino there, and the upper estimate is that there's 70 of them left, which is absolutely ridiculous when you think there was 25 people sitting in the office making this program, and in the whole world there's maybe as few as 30, maybe as many as 70 of these animals left, and their home is under threat from deforestation. For local economy, but also for sale around the world, for products like palm oil. And that's the sort of story where you'll see in the making of, it's sad, it's devastating, but it's something we can do something about, because we all probably consume palm oil, and you can make a choice to consume sustainable palm oil, which does not cause deforestation, or palm oil, or not to look for that difference. And so to me, that's also quite a hopeful thing, because we can make differences.
Yeah. Now, the show is narrated by Sir David Attenborough, who is a legend. What was it like to work with him?
Well, he's 93 years old, but he's an extraordinary individual. If you think most 93-year-olds are, well, most of them are dead, or they can't get out of a chair, right. You know, but David is extraordinary. I mean, in terms of his knowledge of the natural world, you know, I think he's been working, you know, in television and these sorts of programs for 60 years, more than 60 years. So he's got amazing knowledge. But also, just when he comes to narrate something, I mean, his voice and his vocal range is unparalleled. Really. There's no one who can, you know, in one sentence talk about something that's maybe playful and funny, the next sentence something that's poignant and then awe-inspiring, and then give gravitas to something else. That range is absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah,
he has so much enthusiasm and so much love for the natural world, and that really, really comes through, I think, in the series. It's just
definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, he has a sort of boyish enthusiasm still, even at 93.
Yeah, he's terrific at 93. I mean, has he told you his secret?
I think it's
being
just
out in nature.
Yeah, I think it's wildlife and to keep working.
The power for the forest bathing. They say that's a big thing. Huh?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And staying curious. Yeah. That's what I think. That's what I think keeps him going. Definitely. He has this unbelievable curiosity about the world, and I think we could all learn from that.
Absolutely. Well, before we go, tell us a little bit about some of the other firsts that we'll see in Seven Worlds, One Planet.
Well, we've got new species. So the spider, which is in the Australia episode, was only discovered in 2014. It's a brand new species, so that's nice new behavior. Again, in Australia, the dingoes hunting the kangaroos are new. There's something new in every single episode. I'm trying to think. Sometimes it's a new species. Sometimes it's just new behavior that hasn't been captured before. Mm. Maybe you guys can give us examples from your episodes.
Yeah, we found a poison dart frog in the Amazon, which has a fantastic story where the dad frog has to carry individual tadpoles through the forest and deposit them in a little pocket of water and leaves to keep them safe. And he has to remember where he left each one of his tadpoles, but he can't feed them. So he has to go and call his partner, the mother, and he leads her through the forest to try and find the tadpoles, remembering where he put them. And then she can lay an unfertilized egg into a little pocket of water to feed them. And so this, you're looking at this beautiful orange and black poison dart frog, which is no bigger than your thumbnail. And to think that it's going through this incredible partnership, this real parenting story of mother and father working together to look after tadpoles scattered through the forest. That was something that was fascinating for us, a new story.
Yeah. Well, the seven-part series premiere of Seven Worlds, One Planet airs on Saturday, January 18th at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on BBC America, AMC, IFC, and Sundance TV. Emma Napper, Chadden Hunter, and Johnny Keeling, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks again to Johnny, Emma, and Chadden for coming on the show. Once again, the seven-part series premiere of Seven Worlds, One Planet airs on Saturday, January 18th at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on BBC America, AMC, IFC, and Sundance TV. For more information, visit bbcamerica.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.